coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thang, Athletics, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2080 Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. I am your host, as always, Molchar. And on this episode, we're talking horror, specifically the new series of Thistlebone, which has begun in the pages of 2000 AD. The collection is out very, very soon in hardcover format. So we got Tom Eglinton and Cy Davis onto the show to chat about folk horror, important subjects like Time Team and our own favorite folk horror movies. So great to hear from them. We'll chat to them in a second. By this point, you will no doubt have heard about 2000 AD's Free Comic Book Day involvement. Now, normally this happens in May, but this year, because of very obvious reasons, it's been pushed back to August. So we have a rather special Judge Dredd themed entry into the silver title list. Now, Free Comic Book Day is all about supporting local comic book stores. So, you know, it's our Free Comic Book Day issue is something you can only get from participating comic book stores. So make sure that you contact your local comic book store and ask them to participate, and specifically ask them to stock the 2000 AD All-Star Judge Dredd Free Comic Book Day issue to, you know, spread the word of Thrill Power to the masses. So speaking of All-Star series, nice little link there. Like I said, I had a chat with Tom Eglinton and Cy Davis about the new series of Thistlebone, which has begun in 2000 AD. So enjoy this chat about really the most important thing is Time Team. So yeah, enjoy that. Thistlebone collection is coming out in a little while, and the new series has started in 2000 AD. So, Tom, it's been just under 2 years since we had you both on to talk about the first series of Thistlebone. Mm-hmm. Do you want to kind of, not necessarily spoiling the first series, but do you want to update us on where we're at the beginning of this new second series?
So, yeah, so the second series is kind of really set a few months after the events of the first series, which ended with a kind of tragedy with Avril sort of losing her mind and setting fire to the woods in Harrowvale. And we start with returning to Seema, who was the sort of reporter that had kind of persuaded Avril to go to Harrowvale. And she is now sort of quite traumatized with what's happened. She's back at home. And then she learns about this storm that has hit Harrowvale Woods. And because of the damage to the trees previously, this oak tree has been uprooted in the storm and reveals this kind of bizarre archaeological find. And that sort of becomes the catalyst for Seema to go back and investigate the past actions in Harrowvale with the Thistlebone cult. So it's a kind of a kind of unearthing of both the kind of physical and historical aspects of Harrowvale, the sort of idea that the past trauma of the land has kind of been unleashed in the present. And that's sort of, yeah, and that's the kind of setup for the second series.
Because one of the things that really struck me about the first series and very much in the first couple of episodes of the second series is that notion of trauma, is that notion of PTSD. And I guess there's a, that's one of the threads of psychogeography, isn't it? That human experience can affect the land. Are there any particular things that you're drawing on for this series in terms of your research? Because I'm minded of things like, you know, Ian Sinclair and obviously Alan Moore, who does a lot.
Yes, I mean, Ian Sinclair's sort of the most famous for that. With this, it's kind of you know, not too factual in any way, but the some factual elements I did draw on. I was sort of looking into sort of particular events. The tree is an example of something that is sort of has famously happened in a few places. Where the one that I actually mentioned in the comic is a yew tree that blew over and revealed all these ancient skeletons, sort of knotted up in it. And it's such a great kind of image that that was a good starting place. I also sort of drew on quite a lot of just sort of very bizarre occult stuff that I don't necessarily believe in, but I find it fascinating that people do. So there's a book I have called The Dark Worship. It's like this paranoid occult journalism that's about all these sort of different groups that do ceremonies in woods. And, you know, there's photographs of animal hearts with daggers in and weird symbols. And so I sort of drew on that, just all these sort of different elements, and also the sort of psychological aspect, which is always fascinating. So PTSD, like you say, there's something about trauma, both personal and I think sort of historical, that, you know, is kind of relevant, especially sort of nowadays, when we seem to sort of be worried about these ghosts of the past coming back for us.
Well, that's the classic kind of hauntology aspect to the whole thing, that, you know, the past is always with us and the present is, you know, haunted by it. I don't want to ask you about the imagery of this new series, because that first series, particularly with all the images of animals and, you know, the bright eyes and everything, how has the kind of imagery, the iconography that you've gone with, evolved or changed for this second series?
Well, I think, firstly, that to give a bit background from this series, when we finished the first Thistleburn, I think I'm right in saying, Tom, you were relatively quick off the mark with getting going on a second series. Matt was quite keen to get one going, but I'd decided to take a year off, so to do painting and stuff like that. So it was sort of, I knew that there was another series coming, so it was sort of in the back of my brain while I was sort of painting and whatnot. And then I think Tom sent me this picture of the skeleton in the yew tree, and I thought, oh, that's pretty great. So after this year, I'd finished all the commissions and stuff I'd had to do, and then sort of got, I think it was sort of around about a year ago, because I seem to remember doing the roughs and stuff out on in the garden on the table, and then the lockdown started, and I thought, because I use a lot of photo reference in my comics of the characters, and so that was going to be a problem to get to see people to do that. So I decided to rough the whole thing out in watercolor form before I started the actual final thing. And that seemed to work out quite well. But it's not too much of a spoil now because it may be because the third episode's out tomorrow, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. But there's these flashbacks of a Boy Scout troop who there was an incident with them in the 80s, and I decided, because it was slightly perhaps some rum goings on with the Scout Master, I rather than do that in a realistic way, I thought the best way to do that, or a good way of doing that, was to introduce like a cartoony element to the flashbacks. And in a strange way, that makes it even more sinister than if I'd have just done it in a semi-realistic way. So the time I'd had before starting the second series had really given me an opportunity to sort of work out how I wanted the series to look, to be a definite difference between what's happening present day and what's happening in the past, which is done in this cartoony sort of childlike way.
I was struck, no spoilers, but there is a bit coming up in a later episode that I don't know if you've watched Ghosts, the BBC.
Yeah, that's great.
One of the characters from that seems to make quite a vivid appearance in a future episode.
Yeah.
Was that a reference to? Was that used as reference?
Maybe. I think there's all kinds of things sort of creeping in on this one that I hadn't really thought about. I mean, it's been quite nice doing this second series because there's a little bit more. I mean, it's a bit of an unknown quantity in the first series. You didn't quite know it was going to be as popular as it was, and then. So this has been quite nice to take a bit of time and there's a few little, I don't know whether it's Easter eggs, is that the right way of putting it?
Yeah.
There's a couple of little sort of folk horror film Easter eggs in it. I'd be interested to see if anybody notices.
I noticed. Well done, Simon. You? Yeah. But I'm not going to say
In this week's or last week's episode, there was one in that.
Yeah.
In a photo. Did you get that one?
Well, I noticed Forktail was also in there on a cup.
Oh, Forktail was in there, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, an appearance by everyone's favourite archaeologist. Is it Mick the Dig?
It's Mick Austin, isn't it?
Mick Austin, yeah.
Not Mick Austin, he's a 2000.
Oh, no,
I don't know who either of you are talking about.
This is like a ramblings in an old people's home.
It is, yeah. Was he out of that thing with the...
Mick Aston,
yeah.
There we go. Close.
Apologies to Mick Austin.
I do love Murray. He looks great. He's the business.
Yeah.
I'm curious about... was this something that you asked Si to put in, Tom? That it would look like Mick.
Nope.
Right.
So the other thing I should say is I'm just seeing the artwork now. You've done some of the stuff on Instagram stuff, so I'd seen some of it, but this is the first time I've seen it all sort of together. So every week's been amazing to sort of see it come to life. And I love Murray the archaeologist.
He has
come alive. He's like this very cool guy. I'd like to hang out with him. He's totally the sort of.
Well, he's the landlord of the blind beggar, so it might happen. You've hung out with David, haven't you, before? So, it was good fun to do that, and his assistant was slightly Charlie Dimmocky.
I think I did put that in. That was a rough.
You did. That's right. Yeah, you did. It's been good fun.
The reason I bring it up is because Time Team, I think, has a lot to answer for with. As regards the kind of certainly the English folklore revival, because people who were at who were growing up in the 1990s, who were, for example, like myself at university in the 1990s, you know, Time Team, like Sundays ground to a halt when Time Team came on, and the personalities in that and the kind of things that. Because I don't think I'm casting any aspersions when I say that quite a lot of the figures that popped up on Time Team were hippies, and it's that feeling of a connection to the past, of you know, we within places that we recognise within you know contemporary life. Mm-hmm. I wonder, perhaps it's a hauntological thing, but I love the fact that Mick turns up. In a folk horror series in 2018, you know?
So one of the weird things is that in the 90s I was at an archaeological dig, but sort of twice, 2 years running. I was the cook, the Edinburgh Archaeological.
Is this the thing about you poisoning everybody? School. Is this linked to the hen baby?
No, that's something else entirely. The legal case has still not been decided.
I mean, spoilers, but your script does seem to have an awful lot of knowledge of edible and poisonous plants.
I tell you what, I actually do know a lot about how to poison people and with different effects. So if you ever need any advice. So I did this archaeological school. So maybe that's where some of that came from. They were a really nice lot. I really liked them. And they were really disparaging of Time Team as well, which was funny.
Of course they would be.
Yeah, they were like, sellouts. and all the young students that loved it, they were just, you know, they wouldn't speak to them. They're just like, oh, how embarrassing.
Yeah, sellouts, but bitter that they weren't invited to be on it.
Yes.
Incidentally, it's purely coincidental, but a couple of weeks ago, Victor Ambrose, the guy who was the artist on Time Team, he died. And he was a massive influence on me and sort of, he's had this absolutely forensic desire to be accurate with his drawings. His drawings were always incredible. So, and I remember as a kid, you know, getting a lot of his books and whatnot. His King Arthur, Tales of King Arthur particularly was great. And that's quite a sad aside now as we're talking about Time Team.
Mm.
He was always good on that, doing his reconstructions and whatnot.
It's one of those programs which, like I say, you know, everybody watched it. It wasn't necessarily, you know, event TV, but it was always there. And I think, you know, it's shaped an entire generation's attitudes, not just to archaeology, but possibly also towards history. You know,
the high octane digging a trench and finding a little bit of pottery that might be.
Well, the one I remember from that the field school is that the teachers would I think they would bury something like Roman coins just so the students would dig them up, and they did it the year I was there, and they buried 30, and the students found 3 of them. So, you know, that's probably that kind of the truthful aspect of archaeology.
But I kind of with doing this series as well, I think we're the first series I'd already watched it, but I also watched the Detectorists a lot, and that was really influential because that sort of, particularly the last series of that was very much about history repeating itself, but having happened on a site, and then generations later that coming to the surface again, and I really do like that sort of aspect that history has happened and history will happen again, and we'll be the bit that comes to the surface in 200 years time unless we've killed ourselves by then. I quite like that continuity aspect that we're just passing through, but the geography is always going to be there.
Yeah, and I think looking into the second series, there's quite a lot of it is that idea of the unearthing and the kind of all the different routes that kind of kind of create this sort of mythology around Thistlebone. So it's never it's kind of invented as it goes along by these different groups and different traumatic events, which I sort of quite like. It's not so. It's kind of almost a ghost story, but for kind of rational people. I don't know. You know, it's that kind of feeling.
Well, I think we talked last time about the kind of M.R. James style connection to the geography of the past. You know. And how we, particularly in an age when people are a lot more transient, you know, we move to places, we don't necessarily spend our entire lives in the same place. And so the idea of something being always being there is a kind of ghost. You know, you don't have to go down the Ian Sinclair psychogeography route to necessarily be haunted by the fact that, as you say, we are just passing through, you know, sometimes quite literally.
Yeah, we are the ghosts.
Exactly.
You know, we're just the sort of, yeah, we are just as because it's almost like that weight of that knowledge, the more you learn and the more you understand, you sort of realize how not quite as insignificant your life is, but how the land is just so much bigger than you could ever be. You know, it is a kind of living thing.
A few years ago when my dad died, and I was looking through some old photographs that of when I was a kid, and particularly one where we were walking down Little Lane in a village next to where we used to live, and I had this photo, and I went to this lane, and it hadn't changed at all in sort of 40 years, and I held this picture up and matched it to the lane and took a photograph of me holding it up. And I mean, it's not a new idea. Lots of people have done it, but I just found that so moving that nothing had changed. And this little bit of road where me and my, you know, when I was about eight, and there's this photo of him holding my hand as we're walking up. And you just think, God, that's quite spooky and moving in the same way that here I am 40 years later, and nothing has changed in the geography except a lifetime of me being alive and my dad having died. And it's quite incredible, that sort of thing. I do, that's maybe sort of informed a lot of the stuff I did on this series of, you know, just things changing, but sort of staying the same to a certain degree. That was a bit.
We've got quite deep quite quickly on this episode.
Yes.
let's bring this back to talking about the characters, because you've got Seema and Janice. Tom, do you want to tell us a little bit about whether these characters come from like a starting point? Whether it's I need somebody in the story to do this, or whether the plot is being driven by the nature of the characters that you've created.
It was sort of so it connects with the first series quite a lot, because it was with Avril. It was a very clear sort of character in mind, which was a sort of and sort of I can identify with someone that's got like quite an unreliable narrator. She's had sort of mental health problems. She's almost overwhelmed by everything. So I kind of thought that was an easy character to kind of flesh out for me. And then really Seema was just like the kind of the foil to that, which is the kind of very rational side, which again, it's kind of, I guess those almost like two different sides of my personality as I see it. So the rational side is the person that's just like, this is all nonsense, and there's a complete rational explanation. So in developing her, it was a mixture between taking that idea of that person and throwing it against a kind of very irrational series of events and how they cope with that. It's kind of got a weird inspiration. There's a Joseph Conrad story called The Shadow Line, which is all about this captain that inherits a ship, and he's a very sort of rational character. And they take this doomed voyage, which everyone is on board is superstitious about, and all the bad things happen. And he's not superstitious, but he still has to deal with the horror as it unfolds and the irrational occurring. And it's how he deals with it. And this is sort of like with Seema, how I kind of sort of developed her. How would she sort of deal with these very irrational things? And how she sort of bounces off other characters like Janice and Malcolm Kinnebrough. We've got back, and Hillman appears in it, and just all these sort of different aspects of human nature.
Because one thing that's immediately striking about both series of Thistlebone is that the primary protagonists are women, and the villains, you know, no spoilers on the new series, but the villains are by and large men. Was that a conscious choice on your part?
Yes, yeah. It just came very easy because it's, I mean, the other aspect of that is a lot of horror is always has female protagonists. It's a sort of weird, it kind of bucks the trend for a lot of stuff. But if you think about Halloween, you know, all the sort of big hairs or Nightmare on Elm Street or something, you know, all these kind of things always had female protagonists and male violent villains. So it seemed appropriate for that. The main thing that was appropriate was that it was about a cult. And that's always, without fail, a kind of male figure takes over a kind of a group and, you know, takes sort of subverts that power to sort of evil ends. Even quite recent stuff like Nexium, I can't remember how you say it, but if you followed any of that in America, totally bizarre. Like these, you know, high level, intelligent people were taken in, and again, it was just like a male at the head of it, and they did some pretty incredibly disturbing things. So this stuff does happen, and it just seems right to have women as sort of protagonists in this. Obviously, the you know, things happening at the moment that wasn't intended in any way, but I just think that's always been the case with horror. It's what you know, one of the unconscious ways that we describe things, and it's an obvious description that is women get attacked a lot and men are the perpetrators.
Yeah, it's true. I started reading a book about sort of folk horror on screen yesterday, and it's quite amazing that things like Witchfinder General and Blood on Satan's Claw, particularly, I like those films a lot, but it's pretty problematic sometimes, the treatment of women. And I know Witchfinder General, it's generally the pretty unspeakable things historically done to women in the name of justice. But Angel Blake in Blood on Satan's Claw is pretty problematic, 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Being tough. That sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, from my point of view, I thought it's really nice to have a female protagonist who is not subject to that sort of treatment, really.
Yeah, and I guess Witchfinder General is kind of almost like you need to remind yourselves of these things because it's kind of, otherwise it'll get forgotten. And even if it's done in a schlocky way, it's still, because the Witchfinder General I still find quite disturbing. It's not got like the gore of modern films, but it's got a real uneasiness to it that is quite effective.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was a kid watching that and the lowering of the witch lowering of the woman into the fire, what I found deeply disturbing. It's terrifying.
There's a great book called The Witchfinder's Sister by Beth Underwood, I think, which is like a fictional account of Matthew Hopkins's sister. Now, we think he had a sister. You know, there's very little biographical information. But it's a fantastic book because it reframes his behaviour not as a quest against witches, who have, you know, none of his victims were witches. And one of the great difficulties of horror is that so often it does reframe victims as deserving in some way, shape, or form. It buys into the actions of the twisted logic of the perpetrator, but you know, Witchfinder's Sister reframes it as he hated women. Yeah. You know, he was a serial killer of women.
Yeah, it's essentially a sort of misogynist act, and which the film sort of does quite well because it kind of ends up being about that, you know, and that's more terrifying than witches. That's what I find with all these things, because it's, you know, like I was saying, that book, called Dark Worship, and it's all about these kind of occult groups, and they do the idea is that they're doing all these terrible things, and that they, you know, subverting all these power lines in the Earth's grid system, or whatever. And it's not that that part's disturbing. It's that there's got to be, it's the projection of that belief that can maybe be more disturbing.
Mm.
Where, you know, and this was both the sort of first and second series, the idea of beliefs being a sort of disturbing aspect in their own right is, a kind of theme that I think is worth exploring. Because it's what is horrors nowadays, and one of them, I think, is other people's belief systems. Whatever your belief system is, it's the fear of other people's belief systems that are just contrary to your own. And that's kind of interesting.
Well, the whole thing with the Hillman cults, you know, in this age of conspiracy theories, you know, the line between a cult and, for what some believe to be a mainstream opinion, is very blurred.
Mm. But you know, that literal cult in America, Nexium, is sort of spelt funny, so I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. But I mean, that's a case of like a very modern cult where they were they had these stars from Hollywood that they'd sort of got involved, the woman from Smallville, and persuade them to do these like sexually sort of graphic things, but also like quite very sort of disturbing control things. And these were all rational people when they went in. It's really fascinating that it's like, it's not that they're, the assumption is to immediately go, oh, they're stupid or they were gullible. The more disturbing part is, what if we're all capable of that to some degree, of being tricked or sort of led into something that's really grotesque. And in fact, in this series, there's a sort of speech along those lines, which is all about how, you know, all our kind of belief systems normally have victims at the end of them. You know, capitalism has its victims as much as Hillman's cult does in Thistleborn. So it's, you know, using some of those ideas to get more disturbed.
Sorry, one thing I want to ask you about that I really noticed in the opening episodes of this series was your use of colour, which is, you know, always very striking. But there does seem to be, and this may well have been something from the first series as well, that you use colour to strike a difference between the real world, as it were, and the world of Thistlebone, you know, that kind of earthy, forested world. Was that a conscious decision on your part to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I quite like the idea of things being unsettling, and the thing that I like, that one of the many things I like about these stories, these Thistlebone stories, is the fact that it is, as Tom mentioned, you know, it is a quite unreliable. Everybody has their different sort of take on what's happened. So therefore, I've sort of, when I was sort of painting it or whatever, usually I try and be really meticulous with characters from panel to panel, but you know, this time I thought, well, I don't necessarily have to be that sort of accurate and with continuity and everything, because, you know, if somebody said, well, that doesn't really look much like, you know, the last time that character appeared or whatever, and you just think, well, that's fine too, you know, it can be so yeah, I sort of consciously sort of tried to make the art a little bit more sort of disconcerting and a little bit more sort of using it as a storytelling tool to be a bit more sort of ambiguous. I mean, in the first series, I mean, you know, thinking about it, you know, the whole thing about Thistlebone, you actually don't know whether that is an actual thing. I mean, there's the Hillman cult and all that. But you don't. You still get to the end where you think, is that actually a thing that's in the woods, or is it just made up? Because you sort of flip between sort of Avril's recollections, and then Avril as a girl, and then so I quite like that, the fact that you could be telling a whole story and none of it's actually real. So and then in this new one, this sort of switching back to a cartoony style when there's flashbacks and stuff, I just thought was another way of doing that really as well.
I did have a really panicky moment because I've seen your roughs that you do to plan things out, and when I saw the PDF, I had this horrible panicky moment that they'd accidentally include that somebody had lettered your roughs.
Oh yeah,
it's so radical. I mean, people will see when they read the episode, but it's so radical, a sudden change. I was like, oh no, that no, it's fine, it's intentional, leave it be.
Yeah. It really helped. I'm just running off, but yeah, this is the whole story done in a watercolor rough, and it really helped to do it. But just to see the whole story, because generally speaking, you're just working on a episode to episode basis, and that's why it's quite nice this year that I took off and Tom had time to do the whole thing. So I got every episode all together, and usually, I mean, different writers work in different ways, but sometimes you get sort of like, generally speaking, you get the main characters all crop up in the first couple of episodes, and so you can plan that. But having the whole thing sort of ready so I could read through the whole story before I started sort of meant I could be a bit, probably develop the characters and design the characters to perhaps change throughout the story. And, you know, because it, the nature of comics or episodic comics like 2000 means that generally speaking, you get a couple of episodes and you work on those, then you get another couple of episodes and you think, and you're reading those and you go, oh shit, I wish I had seen these so I could have done something different with the characters in the first two episodes. So
the writer does something annoying, like sort of suddenly make one of the side characters a main character.
Exactly. Fucking writers.
What can you do with them? Can't poison them.
But yeah, it was helpful, that side of things. Certainly. It was helpful me being lazy and not starting for a year.
I mean, I was going to ask, you know, before I started recording, we had a little conversation about how lockdown has been. In no way, shape, or form, to diminish the pain and the anguish that the last year has, and it is a year this week that the lockdown has wrought. But do you feel it did give you just that little bit extra space, that little bit extra time without everything else going on to focus a little bit more?
Well, from my point of view, I mean, it's generally speaking, my life is pretty much sat in this room or stood in this room and occasionally talking to my wife. And so it hasn't been that much difference, really. It's the only thing is, you sort of in a normal year, is the excitement of going to the art shop to buy some paint. Now that's been denied, and it gets sent to my house, so I don't actually have to go anywhere for that either. So it has been pretty good, and it's, you know, on the one hand, you, like you say, very aware that other people's sort of experience has been pretty grueling, but I've found it quite nice to have this sort of simplicity, sort of given me, that where, you know, when I started doing this was about a year ago or whatever, just to have, this is what I'll be doing, you know, this is what I'm doing. I won't be taking on anything else. And it's quite nice, really. I think, and that's probably an age thing as well, that just have one thing to do.
One thing to concentrate on.
Had one thing to do, So, it's pretty good, really, that I've been just able to devote time to this and not. I think that's the one thing you, if sometimes when certainly, I mean, I think the nature of sort of writing is probably different because, you know, as a writer, you probably have, you know, two or three things going on or ideas that you're developing at one time. Whereas it's very hard to do two. I mean, I've never done it before, but I can't imagine ever trying to do two different comic stories at the same time. That just would be.
No, I don't think you could as an artist. It's like, no. You know, I've described it as like, it's like running a marathon, and the writing part's a bit more like just having a quick sprint.
So it's been really good to know this is what I'm going to do. And by the end of this thing, like I'm delivering the final parts this week to Matt. And that'll be it. So that'll be a nice year long project.
Because with something like this one, and then you said, you know, as soon as the first series ended, Matt was quite keen to get a second series flowing. And I guess this is a question I ask in one form or another with pretty much everything that we talk about on the podcast. And is how much you consciously, unconsciously put in threads, seeds, roots, for potential follow-ups. You know, is Thistlebone certainly in context of the kind of subject matter, is Thistlebone an apocalyptic kind of story where, you know, it has to have an end in order to for that story to be told? Or are you taking it on a case-by-case basis, you know, seeing how well things go or you know, how much you enjoy the particular installments that you do?
Well, with the first series, it was really just about, just wanted to completely concentrate on that one series and make it as good as we could. And it was quite self-contained. But because of the way it was written, with this sort of going back into the past, you know, I didn't know there was sort of stuff there to explore if we needed to. And the second series is it kind of enlarges on that idea of these layers of time. So the possibility is there, but it's just kind of, it is a bit of a case by case basis because it's, I only want to kind of do something really good that I'm 100% behind, and I'm sure Simon's the same. So you kind of want to make sure that, just give me the cash. it's just that really, you know, kind of, I like to concentrate on a series as a very kind of self-contained in itself as a story. So that if you picked up the second series, you could sort of read it and still completely understand it rather than getting too caught up in a kind of massive sprawling epic, but because of that sort of time layering, it does lend itself to being able to tell other stories.
I really like the idea that, you know, we could have a Thistlebone story that goes right back to, you know, because this legend is in within the woods. You could technically sort of go right back to. You know, medieval times or whatever, or Neolithic times even, and then because that's sort of where the deer mask would come from, and then alternatively you could go into a near future or something. I mean I quite like that film a few years ago. Was it a ghost story? Was it with
the one in the shoot,
it was, what's his name's brother, wasn't it? Casey Affleck was in there.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And that sort of has a thing about history, and these ghosts are there, and then there's suddenly they're in amongst skyscrapers because of the new build on where they were. So it's just the fact that they're a constant, but the world is changing and they're haunting somewhere which they where they used to live, but it's vastly changed from when they were alive. And I quite like that. And it gives, you know, it's whether you attend it or not, Tom, there's legs in this to make self-contained stories. Yeah, because there's nothing I find more annoying than the sort of sheer weight of an intricacy of a title that you think, oh, it looks great, but I, you know what, I can't be bothered to start that because I won't get any enjoyment out of this unless I've read all the other whatever. So, you know, so yeah, I think it's good. I don't know if there's any plans to do any more, but
well, we've got to discuss that, haven't we? Now I'm waiting until you finish, so you know, yeah. the back-breaking work is done, and then I'll be like, so, what have you got planned for next year?
I'll do in a couple of years, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in this rod that Simon keeps making for his own back, because you've gone from Slain, which is full of Celtic mythology and the myth and legend and all this, that and the other, to again something else that's very much grounded in a thing of the past. Is this just what Simon Davis does now? Is, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I just really feel at home drawing things which are quite nature based, quite organic. You know, I'm struck. This story's got far too many cars in it than I'm.
I knew that'd be a problem. I knew when I was writing, I was like, if there's any way I could have a horse and car,
yeah, exactly,
I would.
But you know, so that's been, you know, but it's, yeah, I just think I tend to enjoy painting, and that's why 2000's been really good with the sort of, I think it sort of basically did start off as a sci-fi and horror sort of comic, and it's nice to be able that Matt has been sort of open to having this more straightforward horror based thing that enables me to paint nature a bit more and stuff like that.
If you look at some of the best stories of the past 20 odd years, you know, Cradle Grave, Leviathan, yeah, you know, things like Thistlebone, there is a very, and of course, Stone Island that you did with Ian Edgington.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Matt has clearly seen that the horror is something that can work in 2080. And it's not, I think we discussed it before, it's not an easy thing to do in comics quite often, you know, unless you're going for the kind of schlocky EC Comics thing.
Yeah.
The thing I realized, right, comic, you don't, I think probably said this in the last time we spoke, but you don't have the sound that movies have, which is if you look at all your favorite horror films, virtually all, so much of it is to do with the sound and how it, that kind of, you know, it slows you down and then you get a fright, and you've got none of that with comics, and also you don't quite have that kind of shock effect, because people will sort of not often look through the story before they read it, and so you kind of got to approach it from a different way.
Yeah. No. It's certainly one of the most enjoyable things I've done. Certainly, it's been a hoot.
Yeah, me too. I've always loved horror, so getting a chance to do it in 2080 has been great.
One of the things that came up earlier in this chat was talking about the nature of an unreliable narrator. And that's actually quite tricky to do in comics, because people can see things. And, yeah. You know, it's one of those things, oh, you know, seeing is believing. Mm. And because comics allow you to see and, in your own head, hear what people are saying, pulling off an unreliable narrator, you've that's got to work on two levels. You know, you've got to show, but you've also got to tell and kind of pull the wool over someone's eyes in two different ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you get this thing of that you're basically trying to trick the kind of reader almost. But there's the thing, I guess, is that I'm kind of made it almost rational and explainable by having a sort of psychosis induced by antidepressants in the first one. She's on amitriptyline. So I looked up the exact medications that put people into psychosis. And so then that gives you a kind of very rational kind of explanation of what happens, even though everything you're showing is the complete opposite to that. So there's a kind of way that you can do it as long as you kind of give an explanation, drop an explanation in there. That's me trying to have my cake and eat it in the horror world.
you mentioned about not having the soundtrack the movies have, because we did a Thistlebone playlist on the 2080 Spotify series. I wonder if we should send me the list and we'll do another one.
Yeah, I'll have to think of some. That was all my best ones, the first one. I'll be scraping the barrel here with the
I've been listening to I mean, the usual amount of sort of story tapes and all that sort of stuff, but also listening to a lot of Stars of the Lid, and I don't know if you know them, but on that Adam Curtis, the thing you were talking about?
Yeah.
He uses a lot of that in the soundtrack as well. And that,
does he? Okay, yeah.
Really amazing sort of ambient stuff.
Well, it's funny that he also uses a lot of the Thing soundtrack. I don't know if you've ever noticed.
Does it?
But it always turns up somewhere. I think maybe a few other horrors. But yeah, the Thing soundtrack's often in there.
Yeah. I quite enjoyed that that series. I mean, we had sort of like three or four nights solid of watching all his documentaries, and it is slightly overwhelming.
It is, yeah.
It's like just having somebody in your front room just lecturing you about stuff, and rather than you saying, "Hang on a minute, yeah, explain that bit," but you go on to the next one.
Yeah, I always feel it's a bit sort of like he's created his own Odeerism. He kind of sort of explains how everything that everyone does has got these terrible consequences, and then sort of complains about people not having new ideas. Or you're like, but you just said that we're doomed if we do, and it'll all end badly.
He has his sort of, but the absolute opposite happened.
Or and nothing happened. Nothing changed.
Yeah, no, it's good, it's compelling, but, you know, after a while you just think, God, you know, I need to process this and have some time to think about this.
Mm. I do think it's great.
He did touch briefly on the sort of awakening of, or the reawakening of traditions, and that can very quickly turn into nationalism. And I found that pretty interesting. And I was sort of I read a book called The Lark Ascending, and that's all about has chapters about Kibbo Kift and all that, which is sort of like a variant of the Boy Scout movement, which is quite interesting that Boy Scouts is what's featured in this, and how very quickly this outdoor life and this sort of strength and vitality very quickly can turn into the Hitler Youth or something like that. And then all kinds of things go wrong.
I read a fantastic thing that said, all human interactions have Lord of the Flies waiting in the wings, waiting to take over. Regardless of context, regardless of intent, that is always just there waiting, which is very... John Wagner, Alan Grant way of looking at
it. Yeah. And there is a thing where it's that kind of, especially like pagan beliefs, where like the Nazi Party did, but a lot of those fascist groups around that time really started from these quite sort of innocent pagan, you know, belief systems that they were kind of reappraising for their own kind of nationalist beliefs and pride in yourself. So it starts from like a good place, but you know, can get end up in a bad place. And the Adam Kerr stuff touches on that, way that you can draw on the past, but you stir the ghosts that are there as well.
Yeah.
And they can get out of control. So again, it's the idea of the trauma of the land being released, which is, you know, a bit Thistlebone-ish.
I think you probably have, Tom, but I don't know if you've seen it, Mike, that sort of documentary Arcadia that came out years ago. It's absolutely
fantastic, amazing. Yeah.
Really, really brilliant. And I was talking to Adam Scoville, who wrote that really good book on folk horror a few years ago, and he was charged with going through the BFI archives to earmark suitable documentary clips for the director to go through and see if he can construct a coherent film out of. I mean, it is an amazing piece of work that it can be, and that relies a lot on the weirdness of customs and it's not to be trusted, this thing about, you know, and sort of a lot of the Brexit talk fell into that as well, of, you know, going back to how this country used to be. And there's no real sort of, this country didn't used to be particularly anything, really. It's all sorts. It's not a finite base.
I've got a fantastic book, which is it's a compendium of traditions and events, you know, and it goes through the course of the year and tells you, so, you know, you've got wassailing and midsummer and all the usual ones. One of the points the author makes throughout is how many of these are so recent, like late Victorian at the earliest, but an awful lot of them spring out of the post First World War.
Yeah.
Period, where people were searching around for something to make sense of what had happened,
to sort of sensing for a meaning from the past. But and that really kind of influenced my thinking for Thistlebone, because I was looking into these sort of a lot of the pagan stuff, like either the Wild Hunt or the, you know, kind of May Day or Samhain and all these different rituals and folklore. But then once I started looking at the folklore, there were a lot of accusations that this had really just been invented as quite a modern take on stuff that we didn't know what happened in the past. Either way, I thought it was a fascinating thing, because it's the idea of searching for meaning and what's really behind that then, if what you've created is these rituals, they must come naturally to us. So that's kind of a good starting point. Rather than just immediately accepting the, you know, folklore is folklore.
Well, on this particular episode, we started off deep, and I feel like we've gone deeper.
We're going to end shallow.
Yeah, let's go shallow. Let's go shallow.
Well, what I was going to say was to prepare people who haven't necessarily begun the new series of A Thistlebound, or are looking to pick up the collection of the first book. What's a good folk horror film for them to settle down to get themselves in the mood for biting on the Thistlebone?
Oh, well, I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's the obvious one is The Wicker Man, but it's so obvious that I think everyone's seen it. I guess some of the more recent ones I've really enjoyed, like A Field in England, if you like sort of, you know, it's kind of... Trip Out. Oh yeah, okay, yeah. I love that because it does what a lot of films don't do now, which is kind of leave you with more questions than answers, which I do enjoy, because you kind of have to fill in the blanks and you get that feeling that the director definitely knows what they're talking about, even if you don't know what they are. So that's a good one. And Midsummer I enjoyed. You know, that's got quite a lot of similarities to Thistlebone, weirdly. I mean, I'd written Thistlebone in between that coming out and before, and then Thistlebone came out. So it's kind of watched that with a bit apprehensive, worrying that it was too similar. But that's pretty good. It's kind of got a good modern version.
Yeah, I watched that again quite recently, actually. It's very good. And I remember, don't know, keep harping on about my dad dying, but I went to see that coincided. I went to see that a couple of weeks after he died. And the film basically is a film about grief and what to do with that and the feeling to the need to have family. And I found it profoundly affecting at the time. And then I watched it again recently, which I'd been putting off. And I mean, it's really good bit of work, really. It's a great. Mm.
It's one of those films that does relate to what we were talking about, because, you know, it can also be read as a parable of fascism, you know, in the way that fascism undermines the ties that bind us to each other and reforges us anew as it burns the past. But anyway, no, both very good.
Where's the shallow bit start?
Shallow, go to the shallow.
Keep it light.
Yeah,
on that note.
I mean, there's all kinds of fun stuff you could watch. I mean, you turned up to a few, but during the lockdown, we had some sort of folk horror cinema club watching. All of us sort of watched the same thing at the same time. And we watched a few things like episodes of Children of the Stones and stuff like that. And that was quite fun. And so there's some quite good light stuff. But there's some new ones. Like, I think it was, God, what's the one where...
There's the Ben Wheatley's latest one is apparently folk horror.
In the forest, it's something that's on, is it Relic or something? The Relic?
Oh, The Relic, yeah, I've seen that. That's good, yeah.
That was all right, that was pretty good.
The other one, the one I was just looking at the title of it, the black and white Onibaba, it's like a Japanese black and white. That's great, it's really just so sparse, kind of two women in this field and a injured samurai turns up and it just gets weirder and weirder. It's brilliant, really, I recommend that. Very atmospheric, great on a rainy day because it's just raining throughout the film and you kind of, it's just very off-putting.
Detectorist is a good one. Keeping it light.
Oh, I've not seen that. Yeah, Detectorist. Watch Detectorist.
Haven't you seen that, Tom?
I've not seen it, no. It's supposed to be amazing. I don't know why I've not seen it.
Yeah, it's very sweet.
It's very good, but I found it almost soporific.
Yeah.
That it's comedy that's so gentle. I was just like, oh, well.
Yeah.
It's good though. It's good. And that Arcadia, if you haven't seen that, it's brilliant.
That is great as well. Yeah, I recommend that's like ambient. That's quite soporific as well. You kind of, it's lovely in a lovely way.
Yeah. And of course, we've basically been running an advert for Adam Curtis's latest thing all the way through this episode. So let's include him as well. But wonderful. Thank you very much indeed, guys. That's fascinating stuff. Looking to see how this latest series plays out.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
I'm seeing if this works on my background thing. Yeah, Mike.
That's what he does. That's there he is. Yeah, well, lockdown's finishing soon, so we'll all get out and it'll be okay.
I think this would. I don't want to put a plug in here, but I think this would make a good T-shirt. This one with the root going
it would.
Up, and that's where your head is, right up to the top of the T-shirt collar.
Oh yeah, like a little weird root going through it. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Tom and to Si for that fascinating chat about Thistlebone and folk horror and lots of other different subjects, including Time Team. So we're going to be back in 7 days' time. We're going to be talking to writer Rob Williams, who is no stranger to the podcast, not just about the new Judge Dredd End of Days collection, which will, it's out this week, but will have been out by the time that episode comes around. But also doing a deep dive onto early ABC Warriors, which is something that, is a real kind of time capsule of early 2000 AD, you know, roping in Star-Lord with Robusters and, Nemesis the Warlock, everything that came afterwards. So that should be a really great chat. So we'll see you in a week's time. Until then, I hope you're staying safe. I hope you're staying well and protected and looking after each other. See you then, Earthlings. Until that point, it's Splundig Vertwig.
Alert! 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 Full power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.